thought he was too thin, or if it really meant something to her, giving her son something sweet, something that ought to make him happy. It hadn't made him happy. Aniel still couldn't see a milkshake without also seeing his mother's red fingernails tapping anxiously on the table, the only part of her body that wasn't completely controlled. "It's going to be so interesting," she'd said to him that day, "to see what you become." When he turned 20, she sent him a check for $3,000. Nothing when he turned 30. Teresa, on the other hand, had flown into town and taken him to Le Francais, which she couldn't afford. Teresa would send him clippings from magazines, articles about art or swimming or asthma or the Cubs or anything else that made her think of Yale. "Tell me all about it," Teresa said. "You're wooing the rich folks, is it?"
"Partly. We're trying to build the collection."
"You know, you have a gift for charm. Mind, I'm not calling you slick. You're charming like a puppy."
"Huh," he said and laughed.
"Oh, Yale, learn to take a compliment."
He managed to keep her on the phone for 20 minutes, telling her about the gallery space, the donors, the university. She told him the rabbits were into her lettuce, or someone was eating her lettuce, and didn't that sound like a thing the rabbits would do? Yale ran the dust cloth along the television, the picture frames, the antique shaving mirror he kept out here on the bookshelf, the wooden box that housed Charlie's childhood marble collection. She said,
"This must be costing a fortune. Is Charlie there?"
"He's out," Yale said, as cheerfully as he could.
"Well, tell him his old mum had two sons last she checked, and it's been weeks since she's heard from the one she carried."
He said, "We love you, Teresa." It was the absolute middle of the night, Yale could tell without rolling toward the clock, when he heard the door and then the refrigerator, when he saw the hall light through his eyelids. He said, "Charlie?" There was no answer, so he sat up, swung his feet off the bed, and there was Charlie's silhouette, leaning against the doorframe, drunk. Yale would have shouted if he were more awake, but he could just barely manage to speak. "What the fuck happened?"
"I could ask the same."
"No, you couldn't. No, you could not. I go upstairs for 5 minutes. What the hell time is it?" He grabbed his alarm clock, turned the red numbers toward himself. 3:52 a.m. "What happened to you?"
"I went out after."
"After what?"
"The raid."
"There? The cops came?" It was the first thing he'd considered, but he dismissed it so quickly.
"What? No.
After we went to Nico's." Yale looked around the room, made sure he was awake. Charlie said,
"Look, I don't know when you vanished, but by the time we went to Nico's, you were missing. I hope you had a brilliant time. I hope it was splendid."
Yale said, idiotically,
"You went to Nico's." "We raided his apartment."
"Oh."
"We went, you know how his parents weren't going to let Terence back in, but Terence had a key, and he was, were you gone by then?"
Charlie hadn't moved from the doorway. It seemed to take him great effort to assemble a sentence, even to form consonants.
"He had the key, and he showed it to Richard. And Richard said we should all go there straight away. And we did. And Fiona's going to cover for us. And we got his stuff. Look."
He started unwrapping something from his own neck. Backlit as Charlie was, Yale could only see the long untwisting of it. "Is that Nico's scarf?" he was trying to piece it together. That everyone had abandoned their drinks en masse and walked to Clark to divvy up Nico's belongings. That they had pillaged, in the best possible way. And he hadn't been there. Nico wore that stripy orange scarf everywhere. It was how you'd recognize him from across a winter street. What about the servers? The boys with the food?
I imagine they took off. We just moved the party, but you were already doing Lord knows what.
Charlie, I was lying down for like 5 minutes upstairs. Maybe it had been half an hour, but wasn't it basically the same?
I know where you were. It was a great topic of conversation.
And no one came to get me?
We didn't want to interrupt you.
Charlie seemed furious, seething, barely holding something in.
From lying down with an upset stomach? Everyone saw you go up with Teddy.
Teddy? He wanted to laugh, but stopped himself. It would sound defensive.
Teddy left. He walked out the front door when the slideshow started.
Charlie was quiet. He might have been processing something, or he might have been about to vomit. Yell said,
"Even if he stayed, what the hell would I be doing with him? Listen, I went upstairs because I needed to be alone."
Charlie said, slowly, unsurely,
"I saw him. I saw him during the slideshow."
"Are you thinking of the picture? Teddy dressed up as Cher? Charlie, sit down." He didn't.
"Listen, I felt woozy. Then I came down maybe 5, 10 minutes later, 15 at most. And I thought, I don't even know what I thought. Everyone was gone, and I was the only one left. It was the weirdest fucking moment of my life. And I still don't understand why you're getting home 10 hours later."
We went out after. Charlie sounded bizarrely disappointed, as if he'd hung so much anger on Yale's having been with Teddy that he didn't know what to do with himself now.
"Fiona said you were with Teddy."
"Fiona is the everyone who saw this?"
"The main one."
Fiona was wasted. And Christ, she's been a wreck.
"You were both gone. You both vanished at the same time."
"And she saw us do what? She saw him carry me up the stairs like a bride?"
"No, she just... I asked where you were, and she said you were upstairs. And I said, why would he go upstairs? And she said, I think Teddy's up there too."
And then he paused, as if he just heard how ridiculous he sounded. "Okay then."
"But she kept saying it."
"Well, she was drunk."
"Go back to sleep," Charlie said. "I'll be there in a minute."
Yale hadn't expected to fall asleep. But the next time he rolled over, it was 6 a.m., and Charlie was curled into a ball beside him. 2 full water glasses and a bottle of aspirin sat on Charlie's nightstand next to his usual bottles of vitamin B and ginseng. He expected to wake up hungover. It was a scene Yale would rather miss any day, but especially now. At least Charlie's paper had been put to bed early this week so they all could attend the party. The drivers would distribute the paper today while the staff slept in or hunched over toilet bowls. He watched Charlie's ribs rise and fall through his pale skin. Blonde freckles covered his shoulders, his face, his arms, but his chest was polished ivory. He was soft, as if his skin had never seen the weather, and when a bone, an elbow, a kneecap, a rib, showed through, it was like a foreign object poking at a piece of silk. Yale showered and dressed as quietly as he could. He didn't want breakfast. Nico's orange scarf lay on the floor with Charlie's clothes. and on the kitchen counter, in a shopping bag, were other things. A half-empty vodka bottle, Nico's blue topsiders, a blank postcard from Vancouver, pewter cufflinks in a velvety box, leaves of grass. Yale wished he'd been there. Not to wind up with some keepsake necessarily, but just to touch everything, to think about Nico, to learn things about him he'd never known. If you learned new details about someone who was gone, then he wasn't vanishing. He was getting bigger, realer. The topsiders would never fit Charlie's enormous feet. They must have been for Yale. How typical of Charlie. Even when he was furious, even when he thought Yale might have been screwing around with someone else, he'd gotten him a present. Yale slipped off his own loafers and slid the shoes on. They were snug, his toes pushing against the stitching and puckered leather, but he liked it that way, his feet being squeezed by Nico. They didn't look right with his khakis, but they didn't look wrong exactly either. He took the L from Belmont up to Evanston, resting the back of his head against the window. What had once been the center of a cowlick was growing into a small bald spot. Unfair, he was only 31, mercifully hidden by the dark curls around it. If he found a good angle, the coolness of the window soaked into his scalp, chilled his whole body. Yesterday it had been too warm for coats. Today you'd be miserable without one. Even so, the air felt good, bracing. And the cold walk from the station to the gallery was nice, too. It was just after 7, only joggers out. The brig occupied the ground floor of what used to be a small classroom building, with a modified hallway serving as the gallery itself. The heating was temperamental, and voices traveled through the walls, but the place had character. They had room for only small shows right now, and the hope was to outgrow this space in the next few years, and, this was where Yale came in, to have the money to outgrow it. Part of which had to do with fundraising, and part of which had to do with sucking up to the president, the university board. Yale's office was made smaller by dark bookshelves on all four walls, and he loved it that way. He'd been bringing books from home, one box at a time, but still most of the shelves remained empty, or rather, were filled with dust and old coffee mugs. He was supposed to get a student intern next quarter, and he imagined asking this industrious young person to fill the shelves with auction catalogs, to scour used bookstores for decent art books. His side project for the week was to assemble his Rolodex, and he attempted this now. Pink cards for colleagues, blue for previous donors, green for potential donors, yellow for collectors, white for other contacts. He fed each card carefully into the typewriter, copied out the addresses. But what he'd thought would be a mindless task proved frustratingly complex. The files he'd inherited were largely undated, so he sometimes couldn't tell which of two addresses was current. He typed 4 different phone numbers onto one card, then stopped and realized he should just try calling, introduce himself. But it was too early in the morning, and so he put the card aside. At 9, he started hearing footsteps and smelling coffee. At 9:30, Bill Lindsay rapped on Yale's open door with one knuckle. Bill, the gallery director, had long ears and wet, darting eyes. An old-school academic, all bow tie and elbow patches. Yale was fairly sure he was closeted and would never come out. Bill said, "Getting the worm." "I'm sorry?" "You're early." "Oh, I wanted the weekend to be over." "Have you met..." Bill walked in and lowered his voice. "Have you met Cecily Pierce?" "Several times." It was a ridiculous question. Cecily was director of planned giving for the university, a job at once parallel to and infinitely larger than Yale's. "She called Friday after you left," I think she'll be dropping in. Now, my advice with Cecily is, if you disagree, you don't tell her. You just ask a question. You go, are you worried this could result in thus and such? I'm saying this because I don't know why she's coming down here. She gets these grand ideas. Thanks for the heads up. Bill's eyes swam around the room. I'd maybe... You don't have personal photos, do you? What, of Charlie? Of course not. What on earth was Bill imagining? A Sears studio portrait? Yale attempted to smile neutrally. Good. Just, she's okay. I don't mean to imply otherwise. I never know what sets her off. She's a hard nut. At noon, right as Yale intended to head out for lunch, Cecily Pierce appeared in the doorway with Bill. Cecily had a Princess Diana haircut, soft and voluminous. She was quite a bit older than Diana, certainly over 40, but with some pearls, a tiara, she'd be a convincing double. And yet, there was, indeed, something terrifying about the woman. It might have had to do with the way she briskly looked you over, the head mistress examining you for dress code violations. She said, Mr. Tishman, and advanced to his desk, extending a dry hand. I'm hoping you're free tomorrow. She spoke at a tremendous clip. I can be. What time? All day, possibly all night as well. No evident embarrassment. Either she didn't realize what she'd said, or she already had Yale completely figured out. Behind her, in the doorway, Bill cocked his head, bemused. I'll supply the car, she said. Unless you have one. Do you have a car? No, I... But you drive? I have a license. Let's leave around 9. Yale wasn't sure if he was allowed to ask where they were going. He said, How shall I dress? Warm, I suppose. She's in Door County. Yale knew about Door County, the bit of Wisconsin that spiked up into Lake Michigan. In his mind, it was a place where vacationing families went to pick their own fruit. He said, We're visiting a donor? It's a rush situation, or I wouldn't spring this on you. She pulled a folder from under her arm, handed it over. I have no idea if the art is any good. She clearly has money, at least. But you're the one she wants to talk to. We can go over strategy tomorrow. It's a 4.5-hour drive. Yale opened the file after she left, after Bill Lindsay shot him a sympathetic look and walked her out of the building. On top was a Xerox of a handwritten letter from back in September, the cursive slanted and mannered. Dear Mr. Tishman, it began. So Cecily had kept, for 2 months, a letter addressed personally to him. It was dated after he'd been hired, but before he'd begun the job. Had Bill passed it to her? And now she was throwing this at him with a day's notice. Yale would tell Charlie about it when he got home. Righteous anger was a reliable way to break the chill. It continued. My husband was Dr. David Lerner, Northwestern class of 1912. He passed in 1963, after military service, a medical degree from Johns Hopkins, and a career in oncology. He spoke fondly of his time as a wildcat and wished to do something for the school, a fact I've kept in mind as I've planned my estate. My grandniece, Fiona Marcus, encouraged me to contact you, and I hope this letter finds you well. I understand the Brigg Gallery to be building a permanent collection. This was the aunt, then, that Fiona was talking about last night. The coincidence of it unsettled him, that she should mention it months after the letter was sent, and it would instantly land on his desk. Would Teddy Naples land on his desk now, too, conjured from Fiona's drunken mind? I am in possession of a number of pieces of modern art, most dating from the early 1920s.
The paintings, sketches, and line drawings include works by Modigliani, Soutine, Passin, and Fujita. These have never been exhibited, nor have they been in any collection but my own. They were obtained directly from the artists. I'm afraid I have no paperwork on the pieces, but I can personally vouch for their authenticity. In all, I have around 20 pieces that might interest you, as well as some corresponding artifacts. I am in poor health and cannot travel, but wish to meet with someone who can speak to how these pieces would be cared for. I am concerned that they find a home in which they'll be exhibited, appreciated, and preserved. I invite you to visit me here in Wisconsin, and hope we may correspond regarding a date for meeting. With warmest regards, Nora Marcus Lerner. Mrs. David C. Lerner, Northwestern, 12. Yale squinted at the paper. Obtained directly from the artists was a little suspect. The men Nora Lerner had listed were not, for the most part, ones who hawked their own paintings on street corners to visiting Americans. And this could be a logistical nightmare. Proving authenticity on any one piece, with no paperwork, no catalog listings, might take years. This woman would need to get everything authenticated before it could be appraised for her taxes, and it would either turn out to be junk, or she'd realize how much she was giving away and change her mind. In Yale's last months at the Art Institute, a man was set to donate a Jasper Johns, numbers stacked in a glorious mess of primary colors, until he learned the current value of the piece, and his daughter convinced him to will it to her instead. Yale was a development guy, not an art guy, or at least he wasn't supposed to be an art guy. But he had let himself fall in love with that painting. He knew better. Farmers shouldn't name their animals. But then, the whole reason he'd taken this job was the chance to build something on his own. He ought to be thrilled. A small, cowardly part of him hoped he'd get up to Door County and find that the pieces were such obvious forgeries that Northwestern could refuse the gift. Better, in some ways, than finding a plausible Van Gogh, an invitation to heartbreak. But no, it didn't make a difference really what he found. He'd have to bend over backward for this woman even if these pieces were traced out of an art book, just so he wouldn't offend an endowment case. The rest of the file did little to clarify things. There were further letters, far more tedious, about meeting times, and someone in Cecily's office had assembled a dossier on the Lerners. David Lerner was decently successful, and had given unremarkable amounts to Northwestern when he was alive, but there was nothing to suggest they could afford millions of dollars of art. You never knew, though, where people got their money, or where they hid it. Yale had learned not to ask. And hadn't Fiona and Nico grown up on the North Shore? There was money up there, even if Nico and Fiona were always broke, even if he'd never heard them mention any millionaires. On the bottom of one memo, a handwritten scrawl, "Cecily," it said, "are we involving the Brigg people yet?" The memo was 2 weeks old. Yale should have been indignant, but he did see where Cecily was coming from. He was new. The gallery itself was relatively new. And this was potentially a major donor. She was involving him now, at least. Except part of him wished she weren't. Probably he was just tired. But all he felt was a sort of pre-dentist visit dread. He didn't know what condition he'd find Charlie in. He might be sweet and contrite, or he might still be angry about nothing. Or he might have taken off, buried himself in work to avoid the whole situation. But before Yale opened the door, he heard voices. A relief. A crowd was good. Charlie and two of his staffers, Gloria and Raphael, sat around the coffee table poring over back issues. Charlie was in the habit of overworking his staff on the sly by inviting them over on Mondays to celebrate after the week's issue was out. He'd feed them and then get them working again, right in the living room. As publisher,
Charlie might have been hands-off with the paper, but he'd stayed involved with every decision from alderman endorsements to ads. He owned a travel agency with an office on Belmont, and he'd funneled its proceeds into Out Loud Chicago since the paper's founding 3 years ago. Charlie wasn't even particularly interested in travel, or in helping other people travel. He'd bought the agency in 78 from an older lover who was particularly charmed by him and ready to retire. Charlie only went in once a week these days to make sure the place hadn't burned down and to meet with the few clients who'd specifically requested his attention. He had no problem giving complete autonomy to his agents, but believed his editors and writers required his constant supervision. It drove them nuts. Yale waved and got himself a beer, and disappeared into the bedroom to pack. It took him a few minutes to notice the bed. Charlie had spelled out sorry down Yale's side in M&Ms. Tan for the S, yellow for the O, and so on. He grinned, ate three orange candies from the tail of the Y. Charlie's apologies were always tangible and elaborate. The most Yale ever managed was a feeble note. Yale was debating sweaters when Gloria called him back to the living room. Gloria was a tiny lesbian with earrings all the way up both ears. She handed him an old issue, open to rows of beefcake photos, each advertising a bar or video or escort service. "Flip through," she said. "Tell me when you see a woman, or anyone who isn't a young white guy for that matter." Yale had no luck in the ad section. In a photo of the Halloween party at Berlin, he found two drag queens. "I don't suppose this counts," he said. "Look," Charlie said. He was worked up. "Ads will dominate the visuals no matter what. And we can't ask a bathhouse to show, what, the cleaning lady?" Raphael said, "Yeah, but out and out..." And then he swallowed his words. Out and Out was new, founded by three staffers who'd quit Charlie's paper last year, in a huff that Out Loud Chicago still relegated lesbian-specific coverage to four color-coded pages in the back. Yale had to agree. It seemed progressive, and the headlines were pink. But Charlie's remaining lesbian staffers preferred the editorial control it gave them. The new paper was cheaply printed and didn't have great distribution. But even so, Charlie had stepped up his game in response. Same party shots, but more activism, editorials, theater and film reviews. Charlie said, "Out and Out doesn't have the same problem because they can't sell ads to save their life." Yale grabbed pretzels from the bag on the table, and Raphael nodded meekly. He'd been appointed editor-in-chief after those three staffers left, but he hadn't learned to shout Charlie down yet, and he'd have to. Funny, because Raphael was hardly shy. He was known for coming right up and biting your face if he was drunk enough. He'd started out as the nightlife reviewer. He was young and cute, with spiked-up hair, and he'd worked as a dancer, but he turned out to be an excellent editor. And despite his deference to Charlie, despite the diminished staff, the paper was better than ever. Hipper, too. Yale said, his mouth full, "Gloria, I never see many photos from the dyke bars. Could you do more coverage there?" "We don't like to pose as much as you guys," she said. And when Charlie threw his hands up in exasperation, she laughed at herself. Charlie said, "I tell you what... We'll do a new quarter pager for my agency, and we'll have two women for the photo. Walking along, sharing a suitcase, something like that." Gloria nodded, appeased. To Yale, she said, "He's hard to stay mad at, you know. Story of my life." Yale managed to get back to the bedroom, finish packing. He laid out Nico's blue topsiders to wear for luck. He swept the M&Ms into his hand, put them in his blazer pocket for tomorrow. He dialed Fiona from the phone by the bed. Mostly he wanted to check in, see if she was eating, if she'd made it home safely. He worried about her. She had no family left. Not really. She was close to Terence, but when Terence died too, he could picture a million terrible endings to her story. Drugs and alleys and botched abortions and violent men. And he would ask about this great aunt, but thank her for making the connection. On a selfish level, he also wanted to lead the conversation around to last night, to why Fiona would have said that about him and Teddy. But he could imagine how it played out. She was drunk, confused, devastated, not malicious. He forgave her. And if she'd answer the phone, he'd say so. But she never picked up. He was doing a crossword in bed when Charlie came in, the living room empty at last. Charlie looked at the suitcase and didn't say anything. He went into the bathroom for a long time. And when he came out, he said flatly, "You're leaving me." Miel sat up, put his pencil down. "Good God, Charlie. What am I supposed to think? That I'm gone for one night. For work. Why the hell would I leave you?" Charlie rubbed his head, watched his own foot toe the suitcase. "Because of how awful I was." Miel said, "Come to bed." Charlie did, unfolding himself on top of the covers. "You never used to freak out like this." When they first got together, it was casual for a few months. Yale was still new to Chicago, and Charlie took perverse joy in shocking Yale with the options available to him in the city, the things he hadn't seen in Ann Arbor. He brought him to the Unicorn, the first time Yale had ever been in a bathhouse. He'd had fun laughing at Yale's squeamishness, the way he folded his arms over his stomach, his questions about whether this was legal. They just ended up making out with each other in a corner, in the dim red light, then leaving for the privacy of Charlie's place. Another time, Charlie took him to the bistro and pointed out the men on the dance floor that Yale should, one day, be sure to snog. Charlie used to overdo his Briticisms, knowing Yale loved it. "I feel like I'm part of some news report," Yale had said that night. "You know how every report on, like, Who Are the Gays has that stock disco footage in the background? We've stepped into stock gay footage." And Charlie said, "Well, you're messing it up by standing still and looking frightened." Yale remembered Funky Town ending and Charlie saying, "Watch!" The glitter cannons at the corners of the dance floor shot off, and the shirtless men who'd already looked like fitness models suddenly shone with blue and pink and green glitter. It stuck to their sweat, defined their shoulders. "That one," Charlie said, pointing at a luminescent dancer. "Give that man your number now." Even as Yale had wanted nothing right then but to be alone with Charlie, he'd taken huge delight in the idea of the bistro. There had been one real gay bar in Ann Arbor, but nothing like this. Not a gay disco. Not a space where everyone was so happy. The place in Ann Arbor had been filthy, with a sad jukebox and windows full of dying geraniums meant to obstruct the view from the street. There'd always been a skulking vibe, a sense that any happiness was somehow stolen. Here the music blasted, and there were three bars and a pair of neon lips and multiple mirror balls. The excess of the place felt exultant. There wasn't as much on Halsted 5 years back. Bars were just starting to pop up. People were just starting to move there. And Boys Town, no one had even called it that yet, was just starting to coalesce. And so this place, way down by the river, was where Yale first fell in love with the city. At the bistro, Yale felt entitled to joy. Even if he was just watching from the wall, drink in hand. This, the bistro announced, was a town where good things would happen. Chicago would unfurl its map to him one promising street, one intoxicating space at a time. It would weave him into its grid, pour beer in his mouth and music in his ears. It would keep him. The relationship grew serious that fall. Drunk, Yale whispered into Charlie's ear that he was in love. And Charlie whispered back, "I need you to mean that." And things progressed from there. And for about a year, Charlie worried aloud that Yale hadn't experienced the city's freedoms, hadn't been with enough men, and that one day he'd wake up and decide he needed to live some more. Charlie would say, "You're going to look back on this and wonder why you wasted your youth." Yale was 26 then, and Charlie somehow imagined their age gap to be practically generational, even though he only had 5 years on Yale. But Charlie had started alarmingly young, in London. Yale was still figuring himself out sophomore year at Michigan. Eventually, things settled. Yale was suited to relationships, to the point that Teddy thought it was great fun to call him a lesbian, to ask how life on the commune was going. He'd stayed with each of his first two lovers for a year. He hated drama. Hated not only the endings of things, but the bumpy beginnings as well. The self-doubt, the nervousness. He was tired of meeting guys in bars, would rather lick a sidewalk than look for action in some parking lot by the beach. He enjoyed having standing plans with someone. He liked going to the movies and actually watching the movie. He liked grocery shopping. For 2 years, things were easy. And then, after the virus hit Chicago, slow-motion tsunamis from both coasts, Charlie suddenly, inexplicably worried all the time. Not about AIDS itself, but about Yale leaving him for someone else. Last May, before he realized how deep the insecurity had grown, Yale had said yes to a weekend pilgrimage with Julian and Teddy up to the Hotel Madison, a trip Charlie couldn't join because he wouldn't leave the paper, even for 3 days. They explored the city and danced in the hotel's bars, and Yale spent most of Saturday night listening to the Cubs on the radio. But when they got back, Charlie questioned him for an hour about where everyone had slept and how much they'd drunk, about every single thing Julian had done, and then he barely spoke to Yale for a week. He claimed to understand now that nothing happened up there, but the idea of Yale with Julian or Teddy or both of them had taken his imagination hostage. It was more often Julian that Charlie worried about, in fact. Julian was the flirt, the one who'd offer you a bite of cake off his own fork. The Teddy thing was odd, specific to last night. Yale rolled toward Charlie and decided to apply Bill Lindsay's advice on talking to Cecily Pierce. He phrased it as a question. "Do you think it's possible that all the sickness and funerals and everything, they've made us feel less secure? Because this is new for you, and I've never given you reason to worry." Charlie spoke to the window. "I'm going to say something terrible, Yale, and I don't want you to judge me." And then he didn't say anything at all. "Okay. The thing is, the most selfish part of me is happy about this disease. Because I know until they cure it, you won't leave me." "That's fucked up, Charlie."
"I know."
"No, that's really fucked up, Charlie. I can't believe you said that out loud." He could feel a vein pulse in his throat. He might get in Charlie's face and scream. But Charlie was shaking.
"I know.
Come here." He rolled Charlie toward him like a log. "I don't know what's going on with you, but I'm not looking for anyone else." Yale kissed his forehead, and he kissed his eyes and chin. "We're all under a lot of stress."
"That's generous."
"You get afraid of one thing, and suddenly you're afraid of everything." 2015. Fiona realized, as her cab approached the center of the city, that it was too early. She'd imagined delays and traffic, but here they were at 7:22 a.m., and she'd told Richard 9 o'clock. She had the cabbie pull over and show her, on her fold-out map, where she was, She didn't want to wear out her phone battery till she was sure her charger would work with the converter she'd bought at O'Hare. And then she got out and started walking definitively down the broad sidewalk, even though she wasn't sure it was the right way at all. At the corner, she checked the map again, her face buried in it, suitcase next to her, like the world's most muggable tourist. And it looked like 3 miles. Walking, she could keep her eyes peeled in a way she couldn't from a cab. Better use of her time than sitting on her ass at Richard's, waiting for business hours so she could call the private investigator back. A private investigator? How was this her life? She had booked the first flight she could afford. And the urgency of the packing and dog-sitting arrangements made the whole thing feel like a race. But what was 1 more hour? The video was 2 years old. Still, walking felt like a delay. She should be getting there and doing something. If she saw the Seine, she'd feel better. She just needed to follow it west. Fiona remembered both islands from her high school trip. They'd stopped at Notre Dame, on the bigger island, where some classmate had read grisly suicide statistics out of a guidebook. She passed a father, carrying a little boy on his shoulders. The boy held a Buzz Lightyear, zoomed it in front of his father's glasses. It was a stroke of fate that she'd be staying right in the middle of the river, because hadn't the video shown Claire on a bridge? It had been impossible to tell which one. The video was grainy and didn't reveal much background, but after looking at photos online, Fiona had eliminated a few. It was one with padlocks all over the chain link, but apparently most bridges had that now. She passed bouquinistes opening up their green stands of paperbacks and antique pornography. She stopped at each bridge to see if it looked like Claire's bridge, to see if Claire had been magically frozen to the spot. It was a gorgeous day, she'd failed to notice. And my God, she was in Paris. Paris! But she couldn't summon much awe. Her daughter may or may not have still been involved with the Hosanna Collective, and was probably still under Kurt Pierce's thumb. Her daughter may or may not have been the mother of the little girl in the video, the girl with the blonde curls like Fiona's. All those things felt more foreign to her than the simple fact of Paris. Paris was just a city. Anyone's path might lead here. But whoever thought their baby would get mixed up in a cult? Who imagined this was how they'd experience Paris, searching it for someone who didn't want to be found? It was quite possibly a hopeless quest. When had her attempts to reach Claire not backfired? She'd been thinking lately about a time when Claire was 7, when they'd all been in Florida at the beach. She and Damien still married, just barely. And Fiona had announced that it was time to go, that Claire had already been given extra time to finish her sandcastle. Claire had started to cry. And instead of leaving her alone, instead of letting her have her way, Fiona decided to hug her. Claire pushed her away and ran to the water, throwing herself into the surf with her sundress on. Let her cry it out, Damien had said. But 20 yards down the sand, Claire had picked herself up and walked into the ocean, thigh deep, waist deep. She's not going to stop, Fiona said. And Damien laughed and said, she's Virginia Woolfing herself. But she really was. And Fiona was up and running, knowing better than to call to Claire. Knowing that at the sound of her voice, Claire might throw herself under the waves. By the time she reached her, grabbed Claire from behind, the water was up to her own chest. Claire's feet hadn't touched sand in a long time. That was just one day. Claire had done similar and worse on 1,000 others. But the incident had taken on greater meaning lately. The first time Claire had flung herself off the continent. Fiona crossed to Ile Saint-Louis and passed an ice cream shop, the smell of the waffle cones reminding her that she was starving. And she passed shops selling bright leather purses and wine and Venetian masks. Here, finally, was Richard's building, three stone stories above a shoe shop. "Campo Thibault," it said beside one of the five black buzzers. It was 8:45 now. Close enough. Good enough. She rang, and a minute later it wasn't Richard who came down, but a thin young man in a motorcycle jacket. He said, "You've arrived! I'm Serge, partner of Richard." Richard. "I take you up, okay? You get settled. Richard is having a shower. Then he joins us." Serge plucked up her suitcase as if it were empty, and she followed him up the dark stairs. The apartment was chic and sparse, but the light fixtures and windows and the wrought iron railings outside the glass doors looked wonderfully ancient. And the details on the walls, the relief pattern of vines, and even the light switch panels, had been softened by endless layers of paint. Fiona remembered Richard's place in Lincoln Park, the treacly peaches and pinks. This was its opposite. Bright, monochromatic paintings over gray furniture straight out of an architecture magazine. Serge showed her where she'd be staying, a book-lined room with a white bed and a single plant, and then brought her to the kitchen and poured her an orange juice. She heard Richard's shower end, and Serge called that Fiona was here. Richard called back something she couldn't understand, and it took her a moment to realize he'd answered in French. A minute later, there he was, interrupting Serge's tour of the view. He'd combed what remained of his hair wetly to his scalp, and he wore a pressed shirt that was too large, as if he'd recently shrunk. He cried, "Fiona Marcus in the flesh!" and grabbed her arms to air kiss both cheeks, and although she hadn't used that surname in decades, she didn't correct him. It was a gift. This name of her youth handed back to her by someone she associated with a time when she'd been optimistic and unencumbered. Granted, she associated him with the next years, too. The ones with Nico gone, with Nico's friends, who'd become her only friends, dying one by one and two by two. And, if you looked away for a second, in great, horrible clumps. But still, it was a time she missed. A place she'd fly back to in a heartbeat. "Now, the trick, my dear, is to keep you awake the rest of the day. No sleep whatsoever. Caffeine, but only if you drink it regularly. And no wine, not a drop, till you're rehydrated." "He's an expert," Serge said. "Before I met Richard, I hadn't crossed the Atlantic." "And now how many times?" Richard asked. 20? "Alors, beaucoup de temps," Fiona said, speaking French for no reason at all, and then became certain that she'd just said a lot of weather. She felt dizzy and stupid, and like she really should lie down, against Richard's advice. She said, "You mentioned coffee?" And soon they were sprawled across Richard's gray furniture. She wanted to pry open the clamshell packaging on her converter and charge her phone, call the detective even if it was still 7 minutes too soon. But she forced herself to sit still and tell them how grateful she was for the place to stay, the warm welcome. It felt good, in fact, to rest for a moment, to be Fiona Marcus again, 20 years old again, doted on by Richard Campo again. It filled her up. Serge had made her a latte, right there in the kitchen with a machine that belonged in a cockpit, and now she sipped at the thick foam. He said, "You tell me everything about this guy when he was young, yeah? I need some scandals." At that, Richard went to a low shelf by the windows and pulled out a photo album he'd apparently lugged all the way to Paris and into the new century. He sat between Fiona and Serge on the long couch, started flipping through. How strange to see Richard Campo's work in snapshot form, yellowed Polaroids and Kodak prints. He'd been doing more serious work back then, too. But those photos weren't the ones preserved in cheap cellophane slots. Richard said,
Nico's here somewhere.
And then he must have found a picture, because he handed the album to Serge, tapping a page.
Oh, was I in love with him?
You were in love with everyone, Fiona said.
I was. All those boys.
They were younger, and so open, not like my generation. I envied them. They came out at 18, 20. They hadn't wasted their lives.
You've hardly wasted yours, Fiona said.
He handed her the open album.
I was always making up for lost time.
There was Nico, curly brown hair and long teeth, his face tan and freckled, looking just past the camera and laughing. Some joke, crystallized forever. She had a copy of this photo, but an enlarged and cropped one. This version bore an orange date stamp, 6-6-82. It would be 3 years until he got sick. And this version showed not just Nico, but the two men on either side of him. One was Julian Ames. Beautiful Julian Ames. The other she didn't know or remember. But as she studied his face, she saw above the man's left eyebrow a small, oblong purple spot. Christ, she said. But Richard was busy explaining to Serge the way Chicago had been in the early 80s, the smallness of Boys Town, and the way it still hovered then, somewhere between gay ghetto and gay Mecca. How there was no place like it. Not in San Francisco, not in New York. She tried to wipe the spot away, in case it was on the cellophane, but it didn't move. She stared at these sick men who didn't know they were sick. The spot that was still, that summer, only a rash. She handed the album back and Richard continued his narration. Fiona pretended to peer into his lap as he turned the pages, but really she let the jet lag overtake her vision, let the pictures blur. It was too much.
This was Asher Glass, Richard said. Big activist, a dynamo, the most beautiful voice, a big loud lawyer voice. The shoulders on him, built like a brick shithouse, is what we used to say. I don't think you could translate that into French. I have no idea who this one is. Cute, though. This one's Hiram something, who owned a record store on Belmont. Belmont would be like, I don't know. What's the equivalent?
Serge laughed.
All of Paris? No, dear. Like some street in Le Marais. We weren't that provincial. This was Dustin Giannopoulos. Teddy Naples. A pocket twink, as you can see. Never stopped moving. This one I don't remember either. He looks like a manatee.
I don't know this word. Serge said.
A lumpy walrus, Fiona offered, without looking at the picture. This was Terence, Nico's boyfriend. Yale Tishman and Charlie Keene. That's a saga there. Look how sweet they are. This one's Rafael Peña. Remember him?
This was directed at Fiona, obviously, and she roused herself to nod. She said, ostensibly to Serge, but really to Richard, in a harsh voice she didn't expect.
They're all dead. That's not true, Richard said. Not all of them. Maybe half. Exaggeration never did any good.
This is the American habit, Serge said to Richard. You exaggerate.
Don't listen to her. They're not all dead.
Fiona said, I need a sharp knife. Her poor timing didn't register until both men started laughing, and she realized she hadn't said anything yet about the converter, the clamshell packaging. She explained, and Serge left the room to return with a massive pair of shears. He made quick work of the plastic, and soon her phone was charging happily. Richard said,
"Two things I haven't told you. One's just a minor nuisance. Then one is nothing at all."
Not nothing at all, Sarah said. A very big deal.
But it shouldn't affect you. I didn't mention, when you wrote, that the next few weeks are a bit of a circus for me. I have a show going up.
At the Centre Pompidou, Serge added. A big fucking deal.
But it's all done, all my work, until, you know, the day before. I have a number of interviews, though, and some of them will be kind enough to meet me here. So just ignore, ignore, ignore.
But you come to the vernissage, if you're still here, Serge said.
The preview, Richard explained, for the press and the VIPs. They wanted to do two nights, but I told them I'm old.
The 16th, Serge said.
More than a week from now. Fiona hadn't thought that far ahead.
And a big party in two nights.
I'll... Sure, she said, in what she hoped was a vague way.
The other thing is the nuisance. They're shooting some kind of film on this street. An American one. Romantic comedy, I believe. Or at least they promised no explosions, no car chases. It's this block and the next two down. I don't even know when they start, but it's soon. I'm afraid you've walked into a zoo.
It could be interesting, Fiona said. She was thinking about how Claire used to want to be a director, the way she'd recite entire scenes of Annie Hall or Clue from memory. Maybe things had changed, but the old Claire would have wanted to scope out the filming, to stand behind the barricades and watch the action.
Serge said, "This connects to the third thing."
"There's a third thing?"
"Oh, that's a surprise. Shush!"
"Trust me," Richard said, although Fiona didn't think her skepticism had manifested on her face.
"It's a good one. A very good surprise.
Listen, honey, I'm glad you're here. I know the circumstances aren't ideal, but it's damn good to see you."
"It's good to see you, too." Really, she'd never seen this version of Richard before. This markedly old version. Everyone seemed to hit old at a different point. But sometimes since she'd seen him last, Richard had hit it. It was 9:07. She sat on the floor next to where the phone was still plugged in and dialed the PI's number. A woman picked up, speaking rapid-fire French, and Fiona panicked.
"Hello?"
she said. And the woman repeated herself even faster. Fiona handed Serge the phone, a hot potato.
"Allô?"
Serge said, and explained that he was calling on behalf of Fiona Marcus. "Blanchard," she corrected, and that she was here now and ready to meet. At least this was what Fiona assumed he was saying.
"Bien," he said,
and then covered the mouthpiece and whispered,
"What time?"
Fiona shrugged helplessly. And Serge said things she didn't understand and hung up.
"Half an hour. Café Bonaparte."
"Oh." This was good news. Great news, but Fiona didn't feel prepared. Hadn't changed or looked in a mirror. Hadn't expected to meet the guy till the afternoon. Had no idea where this café was.
"No worries. I take you on my motorbike."
1985. Cecily and her gold Mazda were already outside the gallery when Yale arrived out of breath. It was drizzling, and he hadn't managed an umbrella. She said,
"I brought coffee."
So he sat there, wet, in the passenger seat, holding the hot McDonald's cup, trying to warm himself palms first as she drove north.
"The first thing you need to know," Cecily said, "is that Nora's granddaughter wants to be involved, as well as her lawyer. But there are no financial planners, which is either a gift from above or a very bad sign."
Yale wondered how Fiona fit into it all. Presumably, the granddaughter was her cousin. No, her second cousin. Was that right? I've got music in the console. Yale found some classical tapes and mixtapes, and both volumes of Billy Joel's greatest hits, the first of which he opted for. It started in the middle of She's Always a Woman.